You know, Liz, I went to someone's house the other day for the first time in about 8 weeks. I've only been to my house and a family member's house. But the other day, I actually went to someone who's not related to me. And it was the weirdest feeling. You know, like it wasn't like it used to be before COVID, when we used to go in and out of each other's houses all the time. I was kind of on edge.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. I now call it my new normal. With every week, we have more relaxation, and I find that my anxiety, though it's reduced since the first time COVID came into Australia, right? But now with the restrictions, I get this sense of, what? We still should not be standing so close. Are we all still washing our hands the way that we need to? Because I still get nervous. It's like people are kind of sighing a bit with relief. But I reckon it's this time when we have to be more vigilant. We've heard from so many other countries that we could get a second wave.
Oh, we will get a second wave, absolutely. I'm just watching, for all our international listeners, I mean, in Australia, we've just started to relax some of the restrictions. And so some shops are reopening, cafes and restaurants can have 10 people in them. All of this is just scaring me completely. And I find myself emotionally on a bit of a roller coaster. Some days I'm feeling pretty good, I've got this, I can balance everything. Other days I just feel so overwhelmed still by everything that's going on around us.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And so I've been out and about all the time, as you know, but I have been noticing, even in the hospital, that staff are gathering a little more. Like earlier this week, there were a lot of nurses leaving en masse from the hospital. And I felt like getting a big stick and going, get away, come on, like break it up, ladies, break it up. But I have noticed partway through the week that they've now being more conscious of that. So I think people are getting used to a new world. But I feel like, is it happening a bit quicker than what we need it to be is where I'm left. But one thing that has remained the same, my friend, and that's this. My cupboard. You've got your dressing gown over your head.
We're still here recording these episodes, and that's brilliant. And so just on that note, hello, everyone. Welcome to Social Work Stories podcast. I'm Mim Fox, and I'm here with Liz Murphy. Hello.
Hello.
It's great to be talking with you all. Our last episode, Liz, was about the refugee situation in Australia. And the refugees who are stranded on Nauru. Mark Isaacs was our guest on that episode. And wow, we've had a lot of feedback and reviewer comments about that episode, haven't we?
And I'm so glad, because I felt like it was one small thing that we could do is to remind people about the situation on Nauru, and that there are still people there that are being mistreated, and Australia is walking away from its responsibility with these people. And I felt like at least we had the opportunity to remind people about that. And I'm glad people responded so well.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, with refugees and the many phases of the experience that they go through, and one of those phases is resettlement, where I think the government thinks that everything's fine by that point. But as social workers, we know it's not. It's actually the beginning of the next phase of someone's life. And so I'm really pleased that today in this episode, we're able to hear from a social worker who's working with people in that resettlement phase. And what's really nice about this is it's a very practice-orientated story. So we're not talking theoretically here. We're talking about the nitty-gritty of actually working with someone in that time of change in their lives.
And before we listen to her, I just want to let people know we've got one passionate social worker here, And you can hear it throughout the story. She's got the fire in the belly, and we just love that, don't we, Mim?
We absolutely do. For sure. We both love listening to this story. So we hope you do as well, everyone, and we'll catch you on the other side. Bye.
So I am a social worker and I do work in the refugee space. Earlier, there is a story that sticks out in my mind it's not one of my biggest stories. It's actually a very positive, hopeful story. But what happened throughout the process was quite an interesting process. I got a referral from one of the nurses that I work with about a woman who was coming into the country, who was resettling in our area, who was a victim of trafficking. So, some of our clients are women at risk, and these women are highly vulnerable women who've gone through a lot of trauma, torture, possibly sexual assault, physical assault. So this particular woman had been trafficked from an African nation all the way to Thailand. So it's quite a long process, over a 10-year period. She was a uni student when she was abducted and was a woman in her 30s by her arrival to Australia. And so the first day we went to see her, we knock at the door, the nurse is doing the health assessment, and I ask the psychosocial questions, how are you going? And I see this happy, positive woman who says to me, I have not slept like this in 10 years. I have slept for 3 days straight. I'm happy, I'm eating, I'm safe. And it was such an extraordinary experience, And I thought, oh my goodness, this woman's going to be great. We're not going to need to do anything for her. It's just going to be someone who, settles in and she just gets on the way and, fantastic. It's going to be an easy settlement process for this woman. Anyway, she was placed at this, the place of residence for her was a not insecure accommodation, but more not permanent accommodation. So it's more like a motel. And we know this place because a lot of our single female clients are placed there. It's a bit of a seedy motel. The manager is quite inebriated a lot of the time. And some of our other single females stay there. Anyway, 3 weeks later, we go back to see this woman for a follow-up just to make sure everything's going well. And I find her exhausted, crying, unable to sleep, basically depressed. So she went from this happy woman who was very excited about her resettlement process, ready to get studying, ready to get her life on track. And I found a very sad, upset woman. And I asked what was going on, and she had realized, or what she had found was, every time she'd walk out of her room and down the street, there'd be a group of men standing out the front of this motel. Which, if you think about it, you're a woman who's been trafficked around the world, who's been sexually assaulted, abused, what have you, and every time you walk out of your room, you see a group of men, you're going to feel threatened and re-triggered. And one day she'd forgotten her key in her room, but couldn't find the manager of the motel. So she told one of the other ladies, and she took her to the foyer where the master key was sitting. So it had dawned on her that what she'd actually thought, that she was safe, the place she was staying at, she actually didn't have that security and that anybody could walk into her room at any time. So it was all those re-triggering emotions. And, her main priority at the time was to get safe, stable, secure accommodation. So I work in the health refugee space, and then we have the humanitarian settlement provider in our area. And we made an appointment me and her to go and sit and have a conversation with the humanitarian settlement provider about her getting safe, secure, stable accommodation. And the meeting went, okay, well, Centrelink gives you $230 a week or whatever amount of money it is, I'm not sure. And you can only pay half of that, and there's only two units in this area that are within your budget, and we will not allow you to rent anything more expensive than that. And these two apartments are not very safe at all. And before the meeting, her and I had practiced, and I coached, I like practiced what she was going to say to the housing agent. And she wasn't able to speak. But then I looked at her and said, well, what did you tell me? And then she kind of told the housing agent what she wanted to say. And the housing agent said to her, you could always be homeless. Which had actually, at that stage, just floored me. Now, I am a new social worker at that time. You know, I'd only been in social work for 3 to 4 months. And yeah, I wanted to get up and shout at this woman, but I needed to keep professional. How dare you tell this woman you could always choose to be homeless? So, you know, what the social injustice or the, not the social, the structural injustices, you know, that housing for a woman who's so vulnerable, so alone, to be so out of her reach, it just made me so angry. And there was not much within, you know, what can you do? I mean, housing is, you know, through government housing is very difficult to get at the best of times, you know, and you'd have to have a child that's almost homeless to get government housing. But a single woman in her 30s who is so vulnerable, that's how do you sit as a social worker with that structural injustice? You know, like, we just brought a person here from a refugee camp in Thailand. We plonked them in the middle of Australia somewhere, suburban Australia, and told them, you've got to find housing that's safe, that's secure, for $200 a week. Yeah, that was the, anyway, it quickly, we left the meeting. Obviously, she was very upset. She was crying. It was quite, yeah, she was inconsolable. And then, you know, the amazing hopeful thing was watching her switch from someone who's crying and really upset and needing comfort to someone going, you know what, no, I'm going to get a plan and this is what I'm going to do. And within 6 months of her arrival, she's now working in an aged care facility. She did a TAFE course. And because, I mean, what she had on her side was she had taught herself English throughout the years. So she taught herself English, and then she just had to do, I think, a 2-month TAFE course to get her English accreditation. And then she went on to do a Certificate 4 or something in nursing, and then went to do and became an aged care EN, I think, and is now working towards becoming an RN, a registered nurse, which, you know, is fantastic and amazing, and she's found her own home. But at the time, you know, I was so angry at this structural injustice, this one thing, housing. We bring people here from refugee camps, promising them safe, secure accommodation, and we cannot fulfill that. We can't, because housing is so expensive in Australia and Centrelink just doesn't cut it. So straight after the meeting, we actually went out for quite a long walk. We just walked around until I felt until she felt calm enough to go back to her place of residence or where she was staying. But then over the next few weeks, we both started, like, at every home visit, we would look at TAFE courses or college courses, because she'd come to the realization that this is the place where she was going to stay until she could move into her own place. So her goal switched from finding another place to, what do I need to do to get funds to be able to get my own safe, secure accommodation without relying on anyone else? So then we started looking at TAFE courses, and I think within a week she'd enrolled in her English course, and then she quickly got into her TAFE course, did a placement, and has just recently, so I think at the beginning of the year, has started working at the aged care facility. And those were the interventions. You know, we did talk about her going to counselling. There is an organisation that does counselling for refugees who have faced torture and trauma. But she was adamant that she didn't need counselling at this time. What she needed was to get safe, secure accommodation. And, you know, now that that goal has been fulfilled, I feel like that was when... And again, she said that she still doesn't need counselling. So that's when my intervention ended, when she got her safe, secure accommodation. Yeah.
Let's talk about that passionate social worker. I just loved her reaction, Mim, when she goes with her client to the housing agent that has the audacity to say, well, you could always be homeless. And
You could always choose to be homeless. Who chooses to be homeless, Liz?
You could choose the salt and vinegar chips. You could choose the just the plain salt ones, and you can choose homelessness. But to listen to that social worker, the passion in her voice, like, how do you sit with the structural injustice? We've brought this woman here. What's our responsibility? And I would imagine she would have had to hold herself back from reaching over that counter and shaking that person.
Oh, yes, absolutely. She would have had to stop herself standing on the chair and start yelling. Like, what an insensitive thing to say. Unbelievable. But, you know, housing agents, well, I don't know. I've been to real estate agents with clients, and they live in a whole other world. You would think better from a humanitarian housing agent.
I can't even imagine what it would be like for this client to, I mean, I can't even imagine what it would be like to be in that particular accommodation that she was placed in. But I say that as someone who lives in a very comfortable house near the water, right?
Yeah.
So I'm assuming that this woman who has been trafficked for 10 years has probably been in the most horrendous of circumstances. But that she comes into this place and realises that God knows how many people have access to her room. So what went from a haven to suddenly feeling so incredibly unsafe.
What a horrific moment that must have been, right?
Yes, yes. And then to be told, well, you could go onto the streets. Well, you know, that there's your choice there, right there and then. And then I wanted to... tell people that in this recording, what then happened was, as you heard, the social worker says, and then this beautiful woman planned her way out of that situation, right? So I think she shorthanded the whole experience to the next thing we know, she's enrolled in TAFE, she's got done her 2 months, and
she's jumped forward, hasn't she?
So what I wanted to tell our listeners is that Katie, our interviewer, student, had to go back to the social worker and say, oh, maybe you could talk a little bit about some of the things that you did with your client to get to that point where she was able to successfully complete her education and is now studying to be a registered nurse, whatever. But one of the things that you and I were laughing about, Mim, is that how often social workers will minimise the work that they do, be so client-focused, as this social worker is, so client-focused on the achievements, the strength, the resilience of this woman, that she omitted to talk a little bit about the role she played in supporting this woman.
It's actually the humility, isn't it? Like, she's completely forgotten that she was a part of that process. And that's one of the things about social work, isn't it? That we become invisible around the situation. And we need to be invisible because it's not about us. But on the other hand, as a profession, this is where we fall down, is being able to identify what we did contribute and where our skills lie in those moments, right? So I loved then at the end that she was able to come back and say, oh, yes, I helped her with finding housing and TAFE and all the rest of it, which is good, which is good.
Which is good, but it also shows that she has a very strong awareness of trauma-informed practice, right? So she knows that this not only is it client-driven, the client very much wants to find safe accommodation, but we also know that that is foundational and is required, that you don't go suggesting some trauma counselling as a cure-all when this woman needs to actually feel safe in her environment and be able to look after herself financially, and also sees that education is a pathway out of her current situation. And Mim, it may be that she never wants to do any counselling or therapeutic work, and that is also totally fine.
But I do think, Liz, it takes a fair amount of security and confidence in yourself as a social worker to be able to be okay with not being the be-all and end-all to someone at that moment, that crucial moment when they're being unsafe. Because the instinct is to save the person and to tie up the case with a neat bow. And this is an example of a situation where the social worker had to realise the limits of her intervention and had to realise that this woman, she's lived a life, a horrendous experience for the last 10 years, but she has lived a full life. It's a woman in her 30s. She will continue to go on and live her life now, thanks to coming to Australia, thanks to the being resettled. She will go on and rebuild. The social worker is only a part of that process, right? So she can suggest counselling, but ultimately this woman will know when the time is right for her to enter counselling. And if the time appears, it may, like you said, it may not. And it's likely not to be this social worker when that moment comes. I think that takes some security within yourself and confidence in the role that you play in people's lives.
I agree. And I really liked the way that this social worker chose this story, because it was one of hope and resilience. I think she acknowledged that whilst it was possibly not the biggest case that she's ever worked on, it was a story of strength and hope. And it certainly was for me. As I listened to this, I could see strength and hope for both parties. Like, you know, so definitely for the client, but also from the perspective of the social worker, it's an absolute joy when you work with people that take agency and who can see the steps towards recovery or safety in this case, or self-sufficiency. What a privilege it is to be companioning and supporting this person to achieve that. And in some regards, less is possibly more. For working with certain clients, and I would suspect that this would be the case with this woman.
Yeah, I think that's true. I'm also thinking, Liz, about the various students I've worked with over the years who have gone through these similar sorts of experiences, and they're now resettled in Australia, but they actually have a history of trauma, torture, trafficking themselves, having come from various countries and finding themselves in Australia. And I'm always bowled over by the strength and resilience it takes not only
to re-enter education as a system in and of itself, but to re-enter into social work, where you are actually having to reflect on your experiences and process at the same time as studying. I'm always hugely impressed by the resilience of those students.
And Mim, do you have thoughts about the richness of the practice that can come from a social worker that has that lived experience? Like, have you any thoughts on what type of social worker these students will make?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, look, we often talk about where lived experience sits in our practice, right? So we all, you know, the beautiful tapestry of life is that we have all had our own versions of lived experience. And we're never going to work with someone who has had exactly our experience, ever. But we will always work with people who have elements of our emotional experiences or our actual factual experiences. For someone to have experienced themselves torture and trauma and trafficking in this way, to then go and work in an environment with people who are resettling after those experiences, I think it's not only an example of enacting your process, but I think it's also about the depth and richness of connection and empathy. Very brave way of practicing, and one that I think really makes me question some of those more Western notions that we have around professionalism and boundaries, and whether those are always the most appropriate understandings of those notions.
Mm. We've reflected on that in the past on some of our episodes, haven't we?
We have, and I think we've talked about it in the context of domestic violence. And when you've had that lived experience yourself and then go to work in that environment. But I think the same can be said for so many different areas of vulnerability, right? So it really comes down to why you've chosen to do social work, why you've chosen to work with the client group that you've chosen to work with, and how you make sense of your own lived experience in the context of those clients' experiences themselves that you're hearing on a daily basis.
Whoa. Sometimes we start a conversation, Mim, and I think we're going in one direction, and then we take a fork in the road and we end up in a very different place. And I feel like that's just what happened now.
But isn't that the beauty, Liz? Isn't that the beauty, Liz, of processing together, and of we often talk about and have heard from people, our listeners, about how we model supervision and how we model that supervisory dialogue. And I think this is an example of that, actually, where you don't always know where you're going to go in your own processing, but, you know, the end point is a beautiful place to get to.
Well, before we get to that end point, Mim, can we just take another little fork in the road? And it's somewhat related to what we were just talking about. We got this lovely review recently from Michelle, who has reached her own fork in the road around whether she should do psychology, study psychology, or social work. And you and I wanted to give her our thoughts around this. Do you want to start off by...
Sure, sure. Look, it's a very common dilemma, I think, that people have, whether to do social work or psychology. I get asked this question all the time by students, and often people start with psychology and then come over to social work later on. In around the world, Masters of Social Work qualifying programs are more popular and have, you know, taken on a life of their own. And so a lot of people do start with psychology and then come to social work. And so I often say to people that one of the key differences, and there are a few differences between the professions, but one of the key differences, I think, is about the individualized nature of psychology and about the focus on the cognitive processing of an individual in their lives, as opposed to the societal impact or place for change that social work focuses on. The social being the most important part of social work, right? So when we talk about social change, when we talk about social structures, when we talk about social impact,
that's where social work is really interested. Not that doesn't negate the individual at all, and there are many social workers who really focus on the individual processing and impact and go down the therapy route, but the starting point for social work is in the societal context, whereas the starting point for psychology is in the individual context. That's what I usually say to people who are at that fork in the road. I don't know. What do you think, Liz?
Well, Michelle, I'm aiming this at you. I'm going to put my cards on the table and say I am completely biased, completely biased. And I'm going to share my little story as to how I got to be a social worker. So I was originally going to do viticulture. So this is the making of wine, just in case you didn't know. Now, this is like I'm at the ripe old age of 18. I've got to choose a course. So I choose viticulture. Why? Because, one, I'd gone to an all-girls Catholic school and I knew that Hawkesbury Agricultural College had a lot of boys. And they had a very good party atmosphere. Two, I didn't mind drinking wine. So I thought, whoa, viticulture. But so, and this was in the early 80s. So so viticulture. Except my mum says to me, darling, why don't you consider social work? I just think it might be something a little bit more suited to you. Well, let's just say this. Eldest child, big Irish Catholic family, female, middle class. Like I was like the walking stereotype of social workers studying at the time. So I did go into it, and how 35 years down the track, I think I have been blessed in this profession. I have had the richest experience in terms of individual work. I have worked in hospitals, as people know. I've been a counsellor. I've run therapeutic groups. I've also taught in welfare and with social work students. And now I teach social workers. And I've also been involved in community development. So the breadth of what I have been able to do with my career and the privileges that I've had in working with clients at the most amazing times in their lives. I do realise that had I done viticulture, I possibly would be a multimillionaire now because the Australian wine industry just went through the roof in the mid to late 80s. But I don't harbour any ill feelings to my mum, Mim. In fact, I think, no. Whilst I'm a lot poorer, I feel like I have won the lottery being a social worker. I really do. It's a blessed profession. And Michelle, forget about psychology. Social work is where it is. From my perspective, it is the profession to be working in.
I think you're right. I think you're right, Liz, in that there's just so much opportunity in social work that actually you can go in so many different directions. And when you first graduate, sometimes it feels hard to do that. Sometimes it feels like you might be stuck in different areas. And what I would say to you is apply for everything that interests you. You will have to begin somewhere, but there is always a bridge to be built between the different areas. And like you've just described, Liz, you can do community development, you can do individual work, you can do group work, you can work in all this range of contexts. And that's what I love about the stories that we share here, is that they come from a range of contexts so that people can see all the various options that are out there.
So good luck, Michelle. Let us know how you go. Let us know what you ended up choosing.
And unfortunately, Michelle, you chose two biased people to ask the question to. Of course, we're going to say social work.
But because we're social workers, we will not judge if you choose psychology. We will not judge you at all. And we hope that you will still listen to the Social Work Stories podcast despite all that. Some of my best friends are psychologists, by the way. I just want to put that on the table. But good luck. And thank you for thinking that Mim and I might be of use in this big decision in your life. Thank you.
Oh, and to all of you out there trying to make some decisions like that, now you know where we stand. We're always going to push for social work.
Indeed.
On that note.
Oh. Yes, Mim, you know how I'm always hopeless at giving the Twitter handle and the Instagram handle. You're much better at that than me. What if people want to still keep on communicating with us and writing a review, maybe dropping us an email. I'm loving this. She's actually now having to go and double check. I feel validated though, Mim. I do.
If you would like to send us a comment or a question, just like Michelle has, feel free to do so by either hitting us up on Twitter. Our handle is at SOWK Stories Pod. Instagram as well is the same name at SOWK Stories Pod, or pop us an email through our website, www.socialworkstories.com. We would love to hear from you. And it's been really nice with sitting in this practice space again today and being able to have this discussion.
I know, I agree. It's a good old-fashioned Social Work Stories Pod format, just done from the comfort of a cupboard and underneath a dressing gown. And I'd like to say to our listeners, have a great fortnight and tune back in. And I'm sure we'll have other adventures and stories to share with you. Take care.
Stay safe, everyone. Bye-bye.